I am snow and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 18th of 2008. So I picked up an 11-year chip in December, and that's a fucking miracle. I did not know that I was an alcoholic until I stopped drinking. And so I'm going to tell you tonight what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So my my parents were both from Philadelphia. They both grew up in the city, and they were hippies. My mom graduated from high school in 1969 and met my dad, who was Jewish, and my mom was Catholic. Met him at a Temple University in Philly. And sometime in the winter of 1973, they decided that they were going to move away from the city where they'd both been their whole lives and make their way west to the land of the open sky. And so my parents landed in October of 73 in western South Dakota, the Black Hills of South Dakota. And they were hippies. They were going to live off the land. And like my dad, who had grown up in the city, got a weapon and started hunting deer and our food. And my mom grew a garden. And it was like, I was born in July of 1974. So I'm 45 years old. And I was born to hippies. I was born in Rapid City, South Dakota. And the first parts of my life that I don't remember were, you know, living on a ranch and my dad hunting our food and my mom growing a garden. And also like my parents sold pot for their living, but, it was kind of like all the, you know, sweet hippie life. And, when I was about, and my dad dealt drugs the whole time. He was also an auto mechanic, but sold drugs the whole time. And of course did drugs. And when I was 6 years old and my sister was four, my mom said to my dad, you need to stop dealing drugs or, I'm going to leave you. And my dad said, I'm never going to stop dealing drugs. And so he left our house. I think probably at that time it had stopped being quite as sweet and hippie like, and was probably progressing, as we all know this is a progressive disease. And so my dad moved out of our house, but lived in the same, city, or it wasn't even a city. It was like a village effectively. And, my mom had nothing. And, my dad went from the stuff that grows in the ground to, doing and dealing cocaine. And so his disease had progressed to cocaine, which he had never done in our house and never when I was a kid. So he started to deal cocaine and basically terrorize my mom for leaving him and terrorize me and my sister. So my mom had nothing. She had dropped out of college and we were living in rural South Dakota. And so she started getting welfare and food stamps. And that's how she kept us alive. My dad never paid any child support. And things started to get really dark at my dad's house. So he always had weapons in the house. He was dealing drugs out of his house. And so there was a constant line of people coming in and out and buying drugs and doing drugs. And, you know, I was 6, 7, 8 years old and I had grown up with drugs all around me. At first it was just pot, but to me it was normal. I had a saying like, dads are for getting high and bringing home the paycheck. I just thought that that's how, you know, I didn't have much of a perspective on how things were. But things got worse and worse at my dad's house and he got more and more paranoid. So this was through, you know, the early parts of my childhood. So I kind of had two households. Like my mom was a survivor and she was trying to keep us alive. She had ended up starting a business. She's a real scrapper. And so she had ended up starting a business and was getting more and more successful and like being able to support us more. And my dad was just descending. And as my mom got more onto her feet, my dad got angrier and angrier. And the weapon that he had against my mom was me and my sister. And it was our emotional connection to my mom. So my dad hated my mom. He made that very clear. He hated women. He hated his mom and spoke really, really derisively about women. And so I grew up, you know, hearing that women are hysterical and insane and my mom was a cunt and, you know, just the worst kind of stuff. Like when my mom was starting her business and we were still on welfare, my dad turned my mom into the welfare agency for having an extra income that she wasn't declaring. And he did stuff like that. And, you know, he like came once to our house and stole a whole deep freezer full of meat that was like our food for the winter. But my mom didn't have a pot to piss in. And so, you know, she tried to take him to court and remove visitation and was never successful with that. And, you know, as my dad got worse and worse and more paranoid, he, you know, like when somebody, he heard somebody in the driveway, like he had a handgun and would go to the window and just peek out the window and make sure it wasn't the cops. And so I started to grow up with, well, first of all, a lot of chaos. There also were a lot of bad men going through my dad's house, and my dad did not protect me and my sister from those men. And so, you know, sexual trauma is part of my story. It's part of a lot of our stories. And a lot of that is kind of mixed up with the fact that my dad did not protect me from that. So let me see. So all of that is just to tell you that there are a couple themes in there. One is I grew up around drugs and they were a part of life. The second is I grew up keeping secrets because, of course, I could never have friends over at my dad's house. I could never tell people what my dad did. I grew up thinking women were, you know, I grew up hating women because my dad hated women. And so sometime in 1982, I was 8 years old, and my mom met the man who would eventually be my stepdad, and he was a kind and wonderful man. Oh, also, I should say, like, my mom didn't know what was going on at my dad's house, and I didn't have any words to tell her anything, even about being molested. Like, I didn't have any words to tell her, and so I never told my mom. I also was trained to mistrust my mom. And so in 82, I was 8 years old or 84, I guess, my mom met Dave, and Dave was really kind and really wonderful and has become my father. So I've known him for many decades now. But we ended up moving when I was 13 from a very small town in Western South Dakota to Rapid City, which is also a small town, but it was like the big town. And Dave was an entrepreneur, and he was starting to get more and more successful as well. And so basically almost overnight, I moved from this poor, you know, like my dad was a biker by that time. So he had turned from one counterculture to another counterculture. And I had gone from this like poor rural, you know, kind of yucky existence, dad's a drug dealer, into Rapid City, where all of a sudden I was middle class. And I had, like any of you who are my age know, like I had Reeboks all of a sudden and a Swatch watch, and things started to look normal on the outside. And my mom was ready, basically, after dueling my dad, to have a new life. And she was an adult. And she could just almost flip a switch and be like, this is my new life. And, you know, she and Dave had a lot of interest in appearing like things were well, they were, Dave was a business person. He was in a personal, like personal growth kind of industry. And so appearances were incredibly important, and especially the appearance of being a family that had our shit together. And I did not have my shit together. So 13, 14, the first time I took a drink, I was 13 years old. And for me, that was like, just like a coming home, like an integration. And I was at a pool party with my cousin. Somebody had beer and the beer started getting passed out, and it would never have occurred to me to say no. Like, it just, my cousin was a goody-goody and she said no. And I didn't get it. Like, I was like, of course I'm going to do this. And so I drank several beers, got drunk, made out with a boy. So that's also a theme that will come up over and over again. And so those things were just fused together. And I was off to the races, as they say in the big book. For me, that became like, that was something that I knew was going to be part of my lifestyle. And I just sought after alcohol as much as I could. And so through kind of middle school and early high school, like my parents were getting more and more successful, but I still had all the trauma of my background. And I was a real good, like, undercover person. You know, it was important for me to appear like things were okay. So I got good grades. I was popular. I had friends. I wore guest jeans and all that stuff. But underneath it was chaos, and at home it was chaos because my sister and I were, really angry and really, you know, just really fucked up from what had happened in our childhood. And when I was 14, my dad, sold cocaine to an undercover police officer in Rapid City and was indicted and then left town. So my dad was like on the run for a year, didn't know where he was, didn't see him. And he finally came back to Rapid City and got arrested and put in jail. So I was in like mid high school. One part of my life was a middle class existence, a lot of friends, good grades. And the other part of my life is I had a dad in jail, for distribution. And by that time I was just putting anything in my mouth that I could get in my mouth. And for me, you know, it's interesting because I grew up in South Dakota in the late 80s and early 90s. We did not have a lot of white drugs. There was no opiates really at that time. So I smoked a lot of weed, drank a lot of beer, and, did a lot of hallucinogens. Those were my drugs of choice. And all of them were, whenever I could get them, I would get them. You know, we would leave school. We had an open campus, go out and, drink at lunch and come back and take tests drunk. And so it was just, you know, ever present, and I was always seeking it. And my parents didn't know. Mom and Dave didn't know I was hiding it. I was also, I had two stepsisters. I also took them out and got them high. Like my sister took them out and got them high. So I was like a really bad influence to my sisters. The other thing that's part of my story is just, I was so hurting on the inside and so empty that the external validation of men was really important to me. And so I was very promiscuous in high school. You know, that was like, it was sort of part of my pattern of, you know, it's like a night out is how am I going to get fucked up and how am I going to get laid? And when I was about 15, I walked up to a party, and this guy that I'd been hearing about went to school in Colorado and drove an RX-7, Mazda RX-7. Those of you who are not my age, this isn't going to be as awesome for you. But those of you who are, like, you know, these symbols are like just so a part of my early life. And I was like, I'm going to get that guy. And he was 4.5 years older than me, was like the known drug dealer. And we were fast, you know, love at first sight. And so I had this boyfriend in college, and I was 15. And like the summer that we started dating, or I forget when it was, but shortly after we started dating, he got arrested driving from Boulder to Rapid City with pounds and pounds of pot and mushrooms in his car. And so then I had a boyfriend and a husband, or and a father in jail. So he went to jail. He got out like on the weekends to go to community, or on the week during the week to go to community college, and was in jail during the week. But that's also a pattern, because he was my first love and my first addict. He was not my last love and not my last addict. But you know, a guy who dealt drugs and was kind of a hippie and had a big personality, like, was my template. So I basically, yada, 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 just did a lot of drugs and had a lot of sex during college, or during high school, and drank a lot. I got to college. I went to Boulder, where my boyfriend was, and broke up with him immediately. And then just drank my face off. Like, just, I mean, I did school too. I always got good grades. Like, for me, that was such a way to keep up the appearance of things being okay, but also, was always just partying all the time. And, I had in my late high school, had started to develop an eating disorder. And by the time I got to college, I was basically full-blown bulimic. And so I was binging and purging all the time. And after I broke up with my boyfriend, it just got worse and worse and worse. And I always said to myself, like, as long as I can keep my grades up and keep up with school, everything's okay. And by the time I hit my junior year, I was hitting rock bottom with my eating disorder. So I ended up leaving school and asking my parents, Mom and Dave, for help. And they helped me get into my first treatment program, which I was in for an eating disorder. But I was in that program with women. It was a women's treatment program, and it was women of all kinds of addictions. So alcoholics and pill addicts and other people with eating disorders. And I was really relieved to be there. I wanted to be better. And so I did, it was like intensive outpatient. And I didn't go to school. I worked and just went to intensive outpatient for about 9 months, and then went back to school. In that program, they advised me to stop drinking. And I stopped drinking for like one hot second. It did not make sense to me why I should stop drinking. And so I started to get better from the eating disorder, but I just kept drinking and doing drugs and acting out with sex, which I didn't think of as acting out with sex. I just thought, I don't know, it's just part of the thing. And so I met my second love and my second addict pretty shortly after I got out of treatment. And it was a woman, and she was an alcoholic. And so I met her when I was 21. We were together until I was 25. She was 11 years older than me and was like a software engineer, drove a hot red car, was kind of glamorous, was really beautiful, and had like all these beautiful lesbian friends. She lived in Denver and I lived in Boulder. And so then I was like, oh my God, I'm so glamorous. I'm like day drinking with lesbians. And I was still in college. Sophie, my girlfriend, was a character, of course, because I love characters. She ended up going bankrupt, getting her house repossessed, and called me up one day and was like, we'd been together for a couple of years, and she called me up and she's like, I need you to take this money and put it in your name, and I'm moving in with you, basically. And so she moved into my studio apartment in Boulder, and all of a sudden we were living together. And so that just went on and on. I also cheated on every relationship that I ever had. So I cheated on my first boyfriend. I cheated on Sophie. And when that ended, I had cheated on her a couple of times, and we had moved out from each other, in from each other, you know, the whole time just had been drinking our heads off. By that time I'd graduated from college. And I said to, I called my parents up, and I needed another bailout. And I said, I need $1,000 and a plane ticket because I need to leave Colorado or this relationship isn't going to end. And it, I wasn't in danger. It was just toxic. And so I moved to Boston, and I was like, my sister was in Boston, and I was like, I'm going to be single for a year. I'm going to cleanse my soul, and I'm just going to party. And so, by the way, at no time in any of this did I ever think that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol or sex. Not one time. To me, an addict looked like my dad, basically. And when I was in high school, I went to visit my dad in jail, and I had done LSD for the first time. And I told my dad in jail, I did LSD for the first time. And my dad goes, you should try mushrooms. So that was like the kind of parenting that I had, you know? And I told my dad once when I was 16, I was 17, he had gotten out of jail, or actually maybe I was 18, I forget. I said, Dad, you have to stop partying. And he goes, well, then what do you do? So, you know, I was like, yeah, I drink, of course. I use drugs, of course. I don't say no to anything, but everybody does. And indeed, everybody that I hung out with did, and probably they used more drugs and drank more than I did. And so I could kind of be like, well, I don't do that. And I'm not my dad. I don't do cocaine. So I had very studiously avoided cocaine because I thought, like, that's my dad's drug. But when I moved to Boston, I moved in with my sister, and we immediately started stealing pharmaceuticals from her roommate who had a bunch of mental health issues, and just pills like spilling out. And so I got into that for a while. I did not love pills. I did not like the amnesia. So that was short lived, but fun for a while. I started looking for a job, and I ended up getting a job in technology, which is what I do today. But mind you, I had promised myself I was going to be single for a year. I'd immediately started sleeping with her neighbor across the street, and a guy like I didn't even like, but I was like, whatever, he's in close proximity. And so I get a job, and in my interview is this tall, blonde, like all American guy. And, but I was like, oh, you know, good looking, but I'm going to be single for a year. And he had, so he was an Ivy League football player. He has a Roman numeral in his name. He's 6'5" and like has a doctor for dad and a nuclear family. Like, parents weren't divorced. So I just started falling hard for him. Also total alcoholic. And, but I thought, you know, like, okay, he doesn't have the shitty background that I have. Like, he was never on welfare. He never had a parent in jail. Like, you know, I thought like, this is a sure deal, you know, a sure bet. Like, if I can be with this guy, like, things are going to be looking up and up and up. And so sure enough, we start to develop feelings for each other. We worked right next to each other. He had a girlfriend at the time and started cheating on her with me. And we were drinking a lot, all through that first winter that I was in Boston. He was cheating on his girlfriend. And finally I, said to him, like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And he left his girlfriend and we became a couple. And so hint, he's my husband today. But the story gets worse. So, so we ended up moving to Orlando and then to Austin. We got to Austin in 2006. We'd gotten married in 2003. And the whole time, actually, you know what, Chris, I just realized I don't know how long I should talk. I can't hear you though. You're still on mute. Okay. All right. All right. I'll fast forward to the important parts. So I was, we were totally in love, like just soulmates. We promised we'd never cheat on each other. Like, we were sort of recreational drug users, but big drinkers. But like if somebody had ecstasy or weed or whatever, we would do it. And that just was our lifestyle. Like, and again, I thought it was like kind of glamorous. Like by that time we'd started to become professionals and we didn't make a lot of money, but we were like two incomes. And, we got to Austin in 2006. And the other thing about our relationship, like I wouldn't say that it was an open relationship, but there were like special rules. Like for me, like if it's girls, it doesn't count. And, like, you know, every once in a while, threesomes and things like that. And I just thought, oh my God, how amazing. I get to have a husband who's got, you know, like I get to have this like normal looking life and then also like bend all these rules and live it up. And so I was pretty perfectly happy with that. In August of 2008, my husband had friends in town and we had gone out one night downtown Austin and taken ecstasy, drank a bunch, just got totally fucked up and came home. And the next night they were going to go out again. That was a Friday night. Saturday night they were going to go out again, but I was really hungover. And the other thing is I didn't drink every day. So I just thought I'm just a party girl. I never thought I had a problem with drugs and alcohol. I just thought I'm a party girl because I was a real binge drinker. And so they went out. I stayed home. My husband came in the door. I heard them come in at about 2 and fell back asleep. And I woke up at 3 and my husband was not in bed. But that wasn't unusual. He like would pass out on the couch in front of the TV. And so I crept downstairs and we had one big great room. We lived in a condo in South Austin and had a big great room. And so I came down the stairs. The kitchen was at the front of the condo. And I looked across the room and I saw my husband passed out at the counter and I had with his laptop open and I had never seen that before. And I just got that feeling like just the hairs on the back of my neck stood up and I walked over to him. He was completely passed out, slumped over in a chair. And I jiggled the trackpad on his laptop and it was just Pandora's box, like sex sites and emails and like, you know, like I didn't know what I was looking at. And this was 2008. So there had not been a lot of sex addiction in the news. Like we didn't know much about it. This was pre Tiger Woods, like, which was kind of the thing that introduced sex addiction as a joke to everybody. But there was all this stuff on his computer and I took the computer and I went upstairs and I locked myself in our bedroom and I just sat there for like 2 hours, just combing through his laptop, not knowing what I was seeing, but it was like my worst nightmare. And if you had asked me 1 second before I walked up to my husband's laptop and jiggled the trackpad, like, has he been faithful to you? I would have put my life on it. And, because we promised and it turns out, you know, I would come to find out over the next few days that I had married a sex addict. And so my third husband, my third love of my life was an alcoholic and a sex addict. And he had been having a double life for the entire time I knew him. By that time, we had been together for 8 years. And I was shattered. I was shattered. And I kicked him out of our house that morning. I called his parents. I called my parents. He ended up waking up and coming up to the room. I hit him, kicked him out. And I was like, oh my God, I married a sociopath. And I remember the morning, like the dawn dawning and watching him drive away in our car and going back into my house alone and just sitting on my couch, like it had been a nuclear bomb and just not knowing like, what am I going to do with myself? And what do you think I did? I started starving myself, spending money, drinking a lot, having sex with a guy and his wife, a guy I worked with and his wife. I bought a new car. In around October of 2008, I met a spinning, because I was over exercising, like everything that I had ever done, I just fucking pulled back in and I was like, this is so painful. I don't even care. And my husband had gone to treatment by that time. And I was living alone in Austin and working. And in October of 2008, I met a spinning instructor at my gym who was also a coke addict and a sex addict. And it was like a one-stop shop. And I was like, fuck it. This is so bad. I'm just going to start doing coke. And I had never done it before because, well, I had done it like one time before, but I had always avoided it because it was my dad's drug. But I was like, I was just in the fuck it's at that point. Like I didn't fucking care about anything. And so yada, yada, like that's how I spent months and months. And I ended up going to my husband's family week because I wanted to understand like what the fuck had happened. And I went to his family week, maybe September of 08. And, it was the first time I understood what a sex addict was. And my husband, when I got there and saw him for the first time, was a changed person. He, you know what it's like when you see people come into treatment and weeks later, like their hair is cleaner, their eyes are clearer, their face is better. And my husband's demeanor had changed. He'd always been like a big, like football playing kind of dick guy, which I loved. And when I saw him in treatment, he was humble. He was deferent to other men in the program that he was with. He read me an accountability statement that was so clear that he knew what he had done. Like he had broken our relationship and he had broken himself. He had hit rock bottom. But I was not ready to get better at that time and we were not living together. So I just descended through the winter. But when I got back from treatment, from his treatment, I thought, well, I'll start going to Al-Anon because my husband's an addict. And if we stay together, then I'll want to be going to these Al-Anon classes. It's what they suggested when I was at his treatment program. And so the first time I went to try to find an Al-Anon meeting, I went to Westlake here in Austin, and it's a clubhouse with several rooms in it. And I did not want to ask anybody anything. I just, you know, was probably wearing a hat and was going in like this. And I took the first right I could find thinking it was an Al-Anon meeting and it was an AA meeting. So this is probably October of 08. And I sat down in that meeting and the topic was probably forgiveness or something like that. And it was 1 hour of serenity. Like I cried through the whole thing. People were really kind to me afterwards. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just go to AA because it's like kind of like therapy. And so I started going to AA, but I was still doing everything, drinking. And but I was like, well, I can go there like for therapy because I'm not an alcoholic. And I was in therapy with a therapist who was actually a recovered alcoholic. And she said to me in December of 2008, why are you going to AA and still drinking? And I said, well, I'm not an alcoholic. And she said, why don't you try to stop? And, you know, I was desperate then. And I stopped drinking. Like I stopped drinking. And when I tell you, like, I didn't realize I was an alcoholic until I stopped drinking. That is the truth. Like it wasn't necessarily hard for me to stop drinking. I stopped, so December 18th, I guess, was the day I had my last drink. I think it was at a company party and it was like some shitty glass of shitty red wine, which I sort of regret. I wish it was some kind of giant legendary Bender, but here's what happened after that. So the first time I went out in public sober, which is such a weird feeling, I went to a party, a rehearsal dinner for a friend who was getting married on New Year's Day, and it was New Year's Eve or something like that. So my first sober New Year's, I was not with my husband, but he was back in Austin. And I said to myself, I'm going to go there. I'm going to drink Diet Coke. And I'm going to go home alone. And I went there and I drank Diet Coke and I sat down next to some guy, struck up a conversation, and wouldn't you know it, I'm like stone cold sober, driving him home to sleep with him at my house. And I didn't even like him. Like it was like, but I woke up on January 1st of 2009 and I was like, oh my God, I thought that my promiscuity was because I was always fucked up. And I realized at that time that it was its own thing, that I was breaking promises to myself. Like I said I wasn't going to do it and I did it. And I felt really, really, really bad. And so I started to realize like, this is not just alcohol. And I also started to realize like my husband, I got to my husband because he's the only kind of guy that would have had me in the shape that I was in. And it's not a surprise that he was a sex addict. And so that's what happened. Like that part of breaking my promises to myself around sex and waking up feeling as hungover as I would have felt if I'd been drinking and using the night before was really my bottom. And I ended up going to a 1 week treatment program in Arizona. And I got there and on day two, I was on the Honest Planet by that time. I was fucking telling people the truth. And I told the truth when I got there. And on Tuesday, they pulled me aside and they're like, 1 week is not going to be enough. You need to go to treatment. So I went to a residential treatment program, 5 week program, in May of 2009. I got there 5 months sober. And I had been white knuckling with sex. So I was basically pretty dry when I got there. I was still starving myself and I was still spending a lot of money, but, I did a lot of work in treatment on trauma and I did a lot of work in treatment on sex addiction. In fact, I got in there and they put me into a primary group with a bunch of sex addicts. And I was like, well, I wonder why they did that. Like, must be because my husband's a sex addict. And, one day my treatment counselor, took me aside. She's like, we got a woman coming in and she's a sex addict. I think you could be really helpful to her. And I was like, oh, wait, oh, that's why I'm in this group. Like, I'm just fucking clueless. Like, I knew in that January that I had a problem with sex and I had kind of known all along because I had always felt bad, but never stopped doing what I was doing. And then I realized like, yeah, this is my thing too. And so my husband ended up coming to my family week and we did a lot of work and we came back to Austin. I came back to Austin in May of 08 or 09. We were living apart. But we started very intensive counseling and we started going to Recovering Couples Anonymous. I don't even know if those exist anymore, but it's a 12-step meeting for couples in recovery, at least one of the part of the couples in recovery. And that was incredibly helpful for us. And my husband was sober and was living a sober life and like making living amends to me. And after we had spent a lot of time, like almost the better part of the year working on our own programs, we moved back in with each other and continued to work on our relationship in therapy and in 12-step programs, and continued to work our own programs separately as well. So, so that's a miracle because I thought that I would never see him again. And I thought I'd married a sociopath. I actually served divorce papers to him right before he went to treatment. But we're still together. We have a 9 and a 7-year-old. So what it's like today is, it takes a lot of work to stay emotionally sober for me. Physical sobriety, like I was relieved of the urge to drink and use. So substance sobriety is not the thing that haunts me. Emotional sobriety can haunt me. Sexual sobriety can haunt me. But I've been clean and sober for 24 hours of 11 years and some change. As far as I know, my husband's sober. I don't work his program. I work my own program. And what working my own program looks like is, I have a sponsor. I talk to her many times a week. I have sponsees, one of whom I met at Austin Recovery, who I love dearly. I go to, in the normal times, I go to several meetings a week if I'm not traveling for work. Right now, I'm going to almost a meeting a day because I love online meetings, and that's been a wonderful blessing of this. I take medication for anxiety. 7 years sober, I hit bottom with anxiety and had to go on medication and realized like I'd probably had anxiety since I was 6 years old, and it had just become part of my life. And when I got on a SSRI, I was like, oh my God, oh, this is real life. Like, it was transformational for me. And so I stay on medication because when I get off of it, it's terrible. And I've tried that a few times. And then I do service work. I take a women's meeting to the ranch as much as I can once a month when I'm not traveling, and tell my story from time to time. And I pray. I don't meditate. I don't like to sit still, but meetings are kind of my meditation. And I just spend a lot of time fellowshipping and making sure that I'm part of the community of recovery. So I'm super grateful for treatment. I'm super grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the main program that I go to. And really, really grateful for you, and really excited. Just, you know, I live in awe when somebody says I've been sober for 24 hours, as much as I'm in awe when somebody says I've been sober for 43 years, because every single length of sobriety is a gift and a miracle. That's it.